Today is Thursday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, both sides dig in as the partial U.S. government shutdown continues with a stalemate.
Why don't you accept what you have already done to open up government?
The U.S. consulate finally met with an American arrested in Russia. Also ahead...
Some people thought that I shouldn't be doing TV. I still think that.
Popular 80s musical icon has died. It's all on today's International Edition. No one budged at President Trump's closed-door meeting with congressional leaders Wednesday, so the partial U.S. government shutdown persisted through day 12 over his demand for billions of dollars to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border with the U.S. border with Mexico.
Every day, Border Patrol encounters roughly 2,000 illegal immigrants. Have to talk about this. Trying to enter our country, 2,000 a day, and that's a minimum. Every week, 300 Americans are killed by heroin, the vast majority of which comes across through our southern border. Our southern border is like a sieve. It just pours through our southern border. And unless we're going to have physical barriers, it's never going to be able to be stopped. Too much money is being made.
House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said that there's no need to prolong the shutdown, and he's disappointed the talks didn't produce a resolution. He complained the Democrats interrupted Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen as she was trying to describe a dreadful situation at the border.
Some on the other side, they wouldn't. Once the secretary started, the Senator Schumer interrupted her, and they really didn't want to hear it, and they challenged some of the points the secretary made. So we were hopeful that we could get more in the negotiation. I know the vice president had sat down with Senator Schumer, had given him paper, had worked to try to come to an agreement, find common ground. I'd hope we'd get a little more of that today. Hopefully Friday we'll be able to get there.
Senator Chuck Schumer, for his part, Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer, said a compromise can be found in time, but keeping the government shut down will hurt Americans.
The bottom line is very simple. We asked the president to support the bills that we support that will open up government. We asked him to give us one good reason. I asked him directly. I said, Mr. President, give me one good reason why you should continue your shutdown of the eight cabinet departments while we are debating our differences on Homeland Security. He could not give a good answer.
Well, Republican Majority Whip Congressman Steve Scalise renewed the president's dire warnings about the border.
One-third of all the women are some are being raped, some are being violently treated. We have children that have challenges coming through. We have another caravan starting to come. We have a real challenge here. And I think that's why both sides can sit down, find a compromise that actually secures the border. We had everybody in the room said they want to have a secure border. So maybe we work a combination to make it solved. And I think that's why the president, I watched him in there stay very calm throughout the entire discussion. He wanted to give the latest statistics going forward. And that is why we will be back on Friday. We want to make sure this border, we want to make sure the border is secure. But more importantly, we want to make sure this government is open. That's why we moved legislation. That's why the vice president went to the Senate when we had the challenge just a couple weeks ago. No counteroffer came back. There was not a counteroffer today, and hopefully Friday there will be.
Well, in one big shift, the new Congress will convene later today with Democrats taking majority control of the House. And Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi said they'd quickly pass legislation to reopen the government without funding for the border wall.
We have given the Republicans a chance to take yes for an answer. We have taken their proposals, unamended by any House bipartisan amendments, but just staying true to what the Senate has already done. Our question to the president and to the Republicans is, why don't you accept what you have already done to open up government? And that enables us to have 30 days to negotiate for border security.
The White House has so far rejected the Democratic package, and Republicans who control the Senate are hesitant to take it up without Trump on board. A White House official, one of two people who described the exchange with Schumer only on condition of anonymity, said that the president's been trying to explain that it would be foolish not to pay for border security. Trump pushed again Wednesday for taxpayer funding of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, even as he claimed without evidence that Mexico's already paying for it through a new trade deal and that much of the barrier has been built. The U.S. leader blamed the shutdown on opposition Democrats because of their refusal to honor his demand for the funding, although last month Trump said he would be proud to own the partial government closure in a dispute over border security. Trump contended on Twitter that Mexico is paying for the wall through the new USMCA trade deal, even though Congress has yet to ratify it and the pact has not taken effect. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Boko Haram raids a military post in northeast Nigeria. How Trump has changed asylum rules in 2018. The Taliban tunnel bomb hits Afghan army base, and Somali teen dreams of lighting cities. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Huntsman met in Moscow Wednesday with a Michigan man who's been detained on espionage charges as the American government seeks answers about his arrest. Huntsman said he offered support and assistance to Paul Whelan, a corporate security executive and former Marine, and later spoke to the man's family by phone but wouldn't discuss the case in detail. Russian Federal Security Service said Whelan was caught, quote, during an espionage operation, but gave no specific information about why he was detained. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo talked about the U.S. response earlier while in Brazil.
We've made clear to the Russians our expectation that we will learn more about the charges, come to understand what it is he's been accused of, and if the detention is not appropriate, we will demand his immediate return.
Whelan was in Moscow to attend a wedding. Joining us to discuss further, Professor Leonid Petrov, visiting fellow at the College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University. Professor, why do you think the Russians arrested this American?
It's very difficult to say anything with certainty at this stage. Even the accusations are very ambiguous, spying in what way, in what form, with what purpose. It looks like it's simply the case of just simply political tit-for-tat actions where Americans arrest a Russian citizen and Russians retaliate. Why are they doing so? It was going to be a very lengthy process, I believe, and Russia will simply keep the person behind the bars as long as necessary. Simply Moscow wants to do so out of the wish to annoy Washington and the allies. And we see it's a much broader case. Like a few weeks ago, the Chinese national was arrested in Canada. And also, again, the charges are very ambiguous and very broad.
Do you think this man was targeted specifically, or do you think this was just a random person a random American that the Russians grabbed hold of?
Well, difficult to say. I don't know the details of the case. Probably I will never know the full picture. But it seems that what was happening during the Cold War era is possible now again. Mm. Anyone who is visiting the other country can be held responsible for the crimes people would not even know, or potentially anyone can be used as a mailbox for delivering a message or being suspected of being engaged in hostile activity, and it will be very difficult to clear any suspicion of the wrongdoing. So again, it looks like the Cold War era of total suspicion and hostility can be extended not beyond to the group of people of secret services, but to anyone else. Basically, any citizen visiting the other country can be potentially held responsible for doing something where people don't even know what is going on.
So we're talking about spies here. We know that in the special counsel investigation here in the United States into Russian meddling into the U.S. election, there has been an arrest related to that of a Russian woman accused of spying here, that it would appear maybe Russia wants back in trade. But would the Trump administration be able to intervene in something like that when it's an investigation somewhat into his own campaign?
Yes, this is a very good comparison. See, no one is immune against the suspicion of potential, you know, so-called Russian collusion. In Russia, it's called anti-Russian hysteria. And in the United States, it's supposed to be a legitimate investigation. The Mueller investigation is considered to find out the truth about the President Trump's potential or possible collusion with the Russian side during the electoral campaign. So no one is immune.
Do you think that this woman, Butina, if she were to be able to be sent back to Russia, that her life would be in danger?
Maria Butina, her life will be in danger. Potentially, it may be in danger because simply she agreed to cooperate with American persecutors. It may or may not, but clearly the Russian Kremlin is now very much involved into what is going on around General Putin, and we don't know exactly what she is being involved into investigation on American soil. And it looks like President Putin is now trying to make statements that she is not involved in anything secret. But who knows? Well, even Petrov and Bashirov also were named by President Putin as people who are totally innocent and had nothing to do with the poisoning of the Skripal's family, you know, in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter what Moscow or President or Russian Federation say. It's very clear that Russia is engaged in some clandestine activities in the other territories, and I wouldn't preclude any possibility of the other nations doing other clandestine activities on Russian territory as well. So for Moscow, it's important to present this case of Paul Wheeler as a tit-for-tat action of the American government on Russian territory, and whether Paul Wheeler was involved or wasn't, the Russian propaganda would use this case just to demonstrate that Russia is doing everything possible to protect the well-being and, you know, peace of the Russians against the crafty actions of American government and Western governments on Russian territory. And President Putin personally will use this case to boost his popularity.
Given that you've said that this could go on for quite a while, from what you know of how the Russians deal with things, do you think that this American will be treated humanely?
Well, I think that as long as the American has the access to the consular protection, consular services, and diplomats are going to visit him, so again, the case is going to be more or less transparent. But how many cases like this are going to be just disappear without much of public exposure? And anyone can disappear in Russia or China without trace, and people probably would not know what was going on. So I'm surprised that this case became well known for some reason, apparently because Moscow simply informed Minister of Foreign Affairs, informed the American embassy in Russia that this American national was arrested. Other cases probably will be unknown, and anyone can disappear in Russia or basically anywhere. You know, like Russian citizens may disappear in Western countries as well without much knowledge of what is going on. So I think that things have been going on for some time, and Paul Wheeler's case just simply became known because Moscow wanted to make it known.
Whelan's family, in a statement, said that posted on Twitter, "We are deeply concerned for his safety and well-being. His innocence is undoubted, and we trust that his rights will be respected." Well, China will not yield on issues it deems to be its core national interests. A commentary in the ruling Communist Party's official newspaper said on Wednesday, that a day after China's president called for cooperation with the U.S. The People's Daily Commentary said, quote, "In matters related to core national interests, China has not given in, is not giving in, and will never give in." China and the United States face a key deadline in March for talks to end their damaging trade war. Trump has said talks towards a deal are progressing well. Gary Huffbauer is a senior fellow at the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics. He talks with VOA Asia's Ira Melman about the ups and downs of statements on the trade issue from the leaders of both the U.S. and China.
The signals from both the White House and Beijing, that would be President Trump and President Xi, go really up and down, and we're in about the third or fourth cycle here, and so we're starting the year on an up note in terms of their signals. However, the differences between what the Trump administration wants and what most trade experts and investment experts think that Beijing is willing to concede are really very, very large. So the surprise to me come March, when supposedly we're going to have an agreement, would be a full-scale agreement that really settles trade and investment relations for the remainder of the of President Trump's term in office. But that would be a big surprise to get a complete settlement, because either that would mean that, President Trump backed off tremendously from the demands that have been made, or that President Xi made concessions which are just beyond what China has ever made in terms of its accession to the World Trade Organization back in 2002, or, you know, any time since. So I'm thinking that the more likely outcome is a partial settlement, but that U.S. tariffs on a very good portion, a very large portion of U.S. imports from China remain in place. So, you know, kind of a half a deal, no complete satisfaction on either side, but not an escalation in the trade war. So that's what my crystal ball says. Of course, my crystal ball may be fractured.
What do you see? What do you see as the major needs for the U.S. as far as concessions from the Chinese?
Okay, the most immediate needs are, of course, for China to remove the tariffs that put on products like soybean and pork and so forth. But beyond that, for China to sharply lower its tariffs on everything and look more like an advanced country. Advanced countries have average tariff levels of about 3 to 5%. And the Chinese average tariff level is really up in the 7 to 10% range. But beyond that, the United States wants China to take moves that essentially allow foreign firms, U.S. firms, of course, but other foreign firms as well, to produce goods or services in China without having to reveal any of their technology to a Chinese joint venture partner or to the Chinese government. That second demand is a really big lift for China, because China has relied pretty heavily on technology sharing, that would be one way of putting it, by foreign companies that do business in China. So conceding on that second one would be a huge step, a huge change in the Chinese economic model up to this date.
Wednesday morning, President Xi said China will not yield on issues it deems to be its core national interest. Do you consider that a core national interest for China?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, earlier China had the Made in China 2025 project, which really advertised a great many high-tech industries, which would be, become important Chinese industries. And the only way that could happen by 2025, which is now, 6 years away, would be to acquire huge blocks of technology from Western companies.
Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. President Donald Trump sent congratulatory messages to each other Tuesday, marking the 40th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between the two countries. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Electric vehicles are on the verge of a major growth spurt, according to many experts. Around the world, concerns about pollution and climate change are growing, and EVs provide an attractive alternative to fossil-fuel-powered vehicles. But higher sticker prices remain a challenge. VOA's Steve Barragona has more on an industry on the rise.
100 electric buses arrived in Chile in November. President Sebastián Piñera welcomed them to the capital, Santiago.
Chile will transform itself. After China, it will be the country with the highest quantity of electric buses in the world.
In Costa Rica, electric vehicles are a key to the government's plan to decarbonize the economy. Manufacturers expect brisk business in the coming years, says EV salesman Mariano Avalos.
I think we heard about a projection for 2030, with about 50% of the cars being electric. Today, we have 600 of these electric units in the country. I believe that next year it will be three or four times that number.
From cars and buses to scooters, electric vehicles are expanding worldwide as concerns about climate change grow. Transportation generates about 14% of the world's greenhouse gases, and oil consumption is growing globally. Air pollution is growing with it. That adds to the allure of EVs in smoggy cities, says a spokesman for Indian EV company e-tron, Saptarshi Chakraborty.
These are all pollution-free vehicles, and the running cost of these vehicles are less compared to petrol and diesel.
Running costs are less because charging is usually cheaper than filling with gas or diesel. Electric motors also cost less to maintain. But EVs still cost more to buy than their fossil fuel counterparts. Government subsidies have driven sales in much of the world. In Norway, where more than a third of new cars sold are electric, generous tax breaks are just one of the perks, says EV driver Christian Bull.
We can park for free, we drive into the city for free. And also the amount of money we had to pay for the horsepowers and everything is much less with these incentives. So it has a big impact.
But the government is rolling back some of the giveaways. Others expire in 2021. That might make an electric car less attractive, says EV driver Ida Vihovda.
If it's the same as a normal car, I wouldn't consider it. But like it is right now, it's much cheaper because of the taxes and the charging. So it's much better to have it now, but they are considering to let us pay for everything as well, so.
The cost of batteries is dropping fast, but EVs will not compete with conventional cars on price until 2030, by one estimate. Subsidies may be needed to reach the government's goals, says the Norwegian EV Association's Stale Frienlund.
We're supposed to be at 100% market share for electric cars in 2025. So to reach that goal, we need to be persistent.
Experts say electric vehicles will likely need help from governments around the world until it's no longer cheaper to pollute. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Well, there are traditions in Africa that some believe need to be revived. Modern fables and folk tales being told at a recent storytelling festival in Nairobi, Kenya, are part of that effort. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
Storytellers from across Africa and beyond gathered to revive a tradition they say is dying out. Wangi Wakamanji is a Kenyan storyteller who incorporates poetry and dance into her tales.
Our histories are important to me, and I kind of talked about that a bit in the story that I told on stage, that they connect us to our memories, our ancestry, and they guide us.
Sanjali Jabate accompanies several performances. He plays the traditional kora, or African harp. Jabate hails from a family of storytellers known as griots in Gambia that has kept alive oral histories in West Africa for more than seven centuries. In the age of smartphones and video streaming services, the art of live storytelling is gradually being lost, according to festival organizer Maimuna Jallo.
I started this journey about 3 years ago, and I traveled to various small villages to look for East African folktales, and nearly everywhere I went, people had no recollection of their own stories.
She says the generation of people who used to tell the stories are now well into old age.
For me, it was really important to see how do we preserve not only the stories, but in particular, the culture of telling stories orally. Because I think it's very different from watching a television program or reading a book. But to have that storyteller in front of you with an audience to be able to interact is something very precious that we're in danger of losing.
The stories address issues shared across African societies such as corruption, greed, war, and nepotism. So if you ever wondered about the folktale, Why Don't Chickens Fly?, it's because the chicken misused all the wealth given to him as king of the sky. When the other birds discovered his wrongdoing, he was banished from the air and became man's favorite food, John Namai told his audience. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Daryl Dragon, the cap-wearing captain of the Capitan and Tennille, who teamed with his then-wife, Tony Tennille, on such easy-listening hits as Love Will Keep Us Together and Muskrat Love, has died. He died Wednesday at the age of 76. The couple also had a TV show, and then Tennille had a show of her own, and here she is interviewing Dragon in 1980.
What are the misconceptions that you think people might have about you?
Well, how many people think I'm dumb? Raise their hand. See, when we had our show, we had a lot of different input. I used to read all the letters that came in, and some people thought I was dumb. Some people thought I was very good on the keyboards. Some people thought that I shouldn't be doing TV. I still think that. It was just an embarrassing situation because I'm mainly a musician.
Well, Dragon died of renal failure at a hospice in Prescott, Arizona, according to a spokesman. Tennille was by his side. Dragon and Tennille divorced in 2014 after nearly 40 years of marriage, but they remained close, and Tennille had moved back to Arizona to help care for him. Dragon and Tennille met in the early 1970s and soon began performing together, with the ever-smiling Tennille singing and Dragon on keyboards. Their breakthrough came in 1975 when they covered the bouncy Sadaka Howard Greenfield song, Love Will Keep Us Together. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. A White House session.